science. He had a big impact on me because in 2007, I went to the Russian Arctic aboard an icebreaker and had a climate epiphany. I learned a lot. I cried a lot. I came back and I went to Steve and he explained climate science for me in a personal tutorial. He later became the first member of the Climate One Advisory Council when I was starting this little thing that was just me called Climate One.
So why did you create this award and name it after him?
Because in 2010, he wrote to me, he was not in good health, he was recovering from cancer. He wrote to me from Europe saying, I got to stop burning the candle on both ends in the middle too. He planned to fly back from a scientific meeting in Europe and come to a Climate One dinner. And he died on the airplane. And that hit me really hard. And I decided to create this award in his honor because he was such a compelling, fierce communicator and could really distill science and make it relatable and very forceful. For example, he talked about the false equivalence that mainstream media outlets employed when reporting on climate science. Here he is in 2009 on the Climate One stage.
When you're covering a complex topic like climate change or health or education or security, and there's no such thing as yes or no. There's all these gradations of possibilities with different probabilities attached. And you go out there and you take a 200 scientist report like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It goes through 3 years of writing, 2 rounds of reviews, 1,000 review comments on every chapter, and then 2 petroleum geologists paid by you know which oil company because they have PhDs that give an equal status in a story or on television. You see, we get a little mad about that. And we call that utter distortion. And they say, oh no, that's balance. It is not balance. It is utter distortion because they are not reporting the relative credibility of the multiple positions. And it means that you're leaving it up to the public and the political world to figure that out for themselves.
And I'm delighted that this year our jury of experts chose atmospheric scientist Ben Santer to receive this award.
Ben Santer recently retired from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. He's now a scholar in residence at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a visiting researcher at UCLA.
He's won many other prestigious awards, including the famous MacArthur Fellowship. But he told me that this award is especially meaningful to him because he knew and admired Steve.
Ben's work has literally changed what we know and understand about climate. His research identified so-called human fingerprints in atmospheric temperature and water vapor and ocean heat content. That led to the conclusion that humans are responsible for changing the global climate, a hugely significant finding. But that was a hard thing for some institutions and people to hear, and even now, there are many powerful people and corporations that do not want to own up to this fact.
That's right, because it flies in the face of people claiming changes in climate are due to naturally occurring cycles. Many times we've heard people say, yeah, the climate's changing, and it always has, and it always will. Ben's work debunked all that and moved the denial machine on to other arguments. I talked with Ben Santer in front of a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, and we started by looking back at a moment early in his career, an encounter that defined his life's work and had a huge impact on how climate is discussed around the world. In 1995, you're in Madrid at a meeting of the IPCC. This is just a couple of years after their first Rio summit. And set the scene. Who's there? What's at stake? What's going on in Madrid in 95?
IPCC plenary meeting. The goal of the meeting is for the governments of the world to approve the summary for policymakers that scientists have been working on for 1.5 years and to accept the underlying report on which that summary is based. The first IPCC assessment in 1990 had essentially said the jury's out. We can't tell whether humans are affecting global climate. But in Madrid, the story was different, fundamentally different. And the bottom line finding was these infamous 12 words, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. It was the first time that the international scientific community spoke with one voice and said, we see it. We can formally identify a human-caused global warming signal.
It's us. It's us, humans.
It's us. And that was a big deal. There were countries present in Madrid, like the Saudis and Kuwaitis, who did not like that finding. they recognized at a time really when scientists did not, that this was some sea change. It meant that at least there was the possibility that they would have to change the way they do business. And one of the people in the room in Madrid was your friend and my friend, Steve Schneider. Steve was the convening lead author, one of the lead authors for the final chapter of that IPCC report called Advancing Our Understanding. That was the chapter that tried to chart the way forward. What are the important things to focus on scientifically? And Steve understood better than anyone else in the room the importance of those 12 words.
And just to jump in, so people who haven't been there, these are literally screens with text on the, you know, big rooms with people literally haggling over commas and words, right? Hundreds of people arguing over one word.
That's exactly right. There was simultaneous translation, so the discussions on stage were being translated into Chinese, Russian, Japanese, and much of the final discussion in Madrid was about the nuances of language. How does a word like discernible translate into Japanese or Chinese? Does it have the same meaning? Who knew? As a scientist, nothing in your career prepares you for having these kind of discussions about the nuance and power of language. But we did. We arrive at these 12 words. We go out to dinner. I just want a beer. I'm hungry. And Steve Schneider was sitting next to me at the restaurant. This is about 2 a.m. on the morning of the 30th of November. And he turns to me in the way that he often did in conferences and said, "This will change the world," this sentence. I had no idea what he meant.
And it changed your life. How did it change your life?
I think it's fair to say that those 12 words upset a lot of people. Powerful companies, organizations like the Global Climate Coalition, a consortium of energy interests, powerful congressmen like Dana Rohrabacher. They understood that this was fundamentally different in 1995 from 1990 and the jury is out. That wasn't threatening. This was threatening to corporate interests. So how do you attack the science? You take down the scientists. You go after the process. You argue that the process was political, not scientific. You argue, as the Global Climate Coalition did, that there was scientific cleansing, as they called it. This 1995, at the time that ethnic cleansing is going on in Bosnia, so that all uncertainties had been purged from the report. It was a nasty game.
And then they actually came at you, and this was one thing to write an article in the Wall Street Journal. It's another thing to come to your house. How did this opposition come to your doorstep?
It's fair to say, as you did, that my life changed with those 12 words. I would be inextricably linked to them for the rest of my life. Nothing I could do or say would separate me from those 12 words. And a lot of people didn't like them. And some people didn't like them sufficiently to actually come to my doorstep. This happened when my son Nick and I were in our house in San Ramon, knock on the door about 10 o'clock at night. I go downstairs to answer the door. There's a dead rat on the doorstep and a guy driving away at high speed in a yellow Hummer shouting curses at me. The police told me to be on the lookout for yellow Hummers, which I have done diligently ever since then.
And you also, when you approached your car, you had some thoughts about...
Yeah, I was afraid. There were people writing threatening letters, sending threatening emails. I had no idea what they were capable of doing. In my opinion, that was the beginning of organized climate denial and organized harassment of climate scientists. If you come up with findings we don't like and you have the temerity to publish them and speak publicly about them, we will come down on you like a ton of bricks.
And it scared your son, too.
It did. It was terrible. As a parent, you want to protect your kids. That's your prime directive, right? To keep them from harm. And the sense that my son Nick did not feel safe in our house after this dead rat on the doorstep incident made me so angry. And anger is toxic. You've got to figure out some way of dissipating that. And I think I did in the end. But the bottom line is, this isn't a game. When you send someone threatening emails or letters or write op-eds in papers like the Wall Street Journal attacking them, there are consequences. And we see those consequences still today, unfortunately.
And Nick, your son at that point was, I think, quite young, and he slept with a wooden sword, right?
Yeah, he had a little wooden sword. I still have it at home that he put next to the side of the bed. Mm. Again, because he didn't feel safe in our house. And no one can take that away. No one can remove that sense of not feeling safe in your own house.
Did you consider quitting science?
In 1996, I did, for a variety of reasons. My life was falling apart. My marriage had fallen apart. And I wondered whether it was worth it, continuing with science. Steve, at that vulnerable moment in my personal and professional history, encouraged me to stick with it. I remember vividly what he told me, that the attacks that I was experiencing meant that the work my colleagues and I were doing really mattered to others, and that in science, you often measure yourself not by the number and quality of papers you accumulate over time that you publish, but by the number and the power of the enemies you accumulate over time. It was sort of welcome to the club, Ben, because at that time in 1996, Steve, who had spoken so powerfully and clearly about the reality and seriousness of climate change, one of the first bellwether voices, had experienced his fair share of public attacks.
Fearless, yeah. Unfortunately, many climate scientists have experienced that. I think you perhaps more than most. You also got harassed with freedom of information requests. Tell us about that. So the harassment kind of moved from rats on the doorstep to other types of harassment.
Well, Freedom of Information Act requests, open record requests, are a legitimate tool for shedding light on complex issues, enhancing transparency in government. But they can also be abused for illegitimate purposes. And in the early 2000s, that's exactly what happened to many climate scientists, not only here in the United States, but also in the UK, where bad actors, folks who were not interested in improving understanding of the science, overwhelmed universities and individual researchers and research institutes with specious open records requests to eat up their time, to throw a spanner in the works, to prevent them from doing their jobs. That still continues to this day, unfortunately, which is one of the reasons I do not wish to have any federal funding. Because if I receive federal funding, then I am subject to those requests.
Right. Ken Cuccinelli in Virginia, there's a number of Michael Mann, a number of scientists have had this to try to, silence, harass, chew up your time. You have to lawyer up, right? And if you work for a national lab, who represents you? Is that the lab's job, or do you have to hire your own lawyer? And there's actually a nonprofit out there that raises money to legally defend scientists, right?
I think the challenge is, Greg, how do you want to spend your time? Do you want to spend your time doing science? That's what I signed up for. I didn't sign up for spending days, weeks, months dealing with a succession of specious Freedom of Information Act requests. That's not how I want to spend my time.
And you spent decades at a national lab. And you are, you know, kind of Mr. Fingerprint. You've kind of pioneered this area of attribution science. Why don't you tell us, what is a human fingerprint and how do we know? Because that science has evolved quite a bit.
I stood on the shoulders of giants. One of those giants was Klaus Hasselmann, who back in 1979 wrote the first paper outlining an elegant mathematical approach for doing fingerprinting, for separating, if you will, a human-caused global warming signal from the background noise of natural climate variability. Think things like El Niños, La Niñas, the rich natural fluctuations in climate on monthly, interannual, decadal, and longer timescales.
You hear that all the time, you know, climate's always changing. It's always has, always will. Eh.
Right. And it does, and will in the future and has in the past. But what we're doing by burning fossil fuels and increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other potent greenhouse gases is we're increasing the ability of the atmosphere to trap heat and thereby warming the surface of the planet and the oceans. We're changing everything. We fingerprinted pretty much every aspect of the climate system, and human fingerprints are everywhere. Hasselmann's key insight back in 79 was, look at patterns. If you move beyond one number, the average temperature of the planet, global mean temperature, and look at the complexity of geographical patterns of climate change or slices through the atmosphere, right from the stratosphere over 20 kilometers above the surface down to the depths of the ocean, then you have a better chance in that pattern analysis of separating human fingerprints from natural climate variability. And that's what I've done together with brilliant women and men all around the world, many of them here in this audience tonight, is we've tried to fingerprint the climate system.
And it used to be, you would hear on the news all the time, well, no single event can be linked to climate change. You have to look at patterns over time. I remember when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, Bloomberg, Business Week, this is climate change, stupid. You know, where are we now? Can we today say this storm, this drought, this flood is climate change?
So in some cases, we can say that this particular event, like the off-the-charts warming in the Pacific Northwest a few years ago, mm-hmm. would have been impossible without climate change.
106 in Portland.
It was so far off the charts, so far outside of any instrumental records, it couldn't have happened without human-caused warming of the surface of the Earth and the atmosphere and the oceans. So what you speak to is this area of research called event attribution, where after the 2003 European summer heat wave, catastrophic event, excess mortality of roughly 70,000 people, warming of nearly 2 degrees Celsius relative to normal temperatures, catastrophic event, and scientists in the UK ran a climate model with human effects on climate and without human effects on climate in order to assess how human-caused warming had changed the likelihood of something like the European summer heat wave. And that is now being done routinely. It's being done by one of my colleagues here in the audience, Michael Wehner, in very innovative and sophisticated ways. The bottom line from pretty much all of this research is we're changing the odds. So Steve Schneider's analogy was loading the die. we're changing the dice so that it's more likely to get longer lasting, more extreme events. Think droughts, floods, heat waves, and that's bad. We're playing a game that's not a game, and we're loading the die in favor of bad outcomes.
From 2016 to 2020, a lot of things happened. Wildfires really took off in the American West. Storms that I can't even remember happened. They kind of blur and roll into another. That was a tough time for you working at a national lab in a political climate hostile to your work. Tell us about that period.
It was a difficult four-year period. I love my job. I was working together with some of the best and the brightest. Such a joy to spend decades of my life together with them, trying to evaluate climate models, trying to fingerprint the climate system, trying to understand how this beautiful and complex world in which we live is changing and why it's changing. But the Trump administration was no big fan of this kind of work, and they did not want us to do this kind of work or to speak about it, or to speak about it in terms of fingerprinting. Folks wanted these euphemisms. And to me, there's no point being a scientist if you're unwilling to speak publicly about the technical work that you do, if you're unwilling to defend it when it comes under unjustified political attack. And I'm proud of the fact that we did. We didn't just roll over and say, this powerful individual, the President of the United States, is incorrectly dismissing everything we're doing as a hoax and a conspiracy. It's not. And we all lose if we let that narrative of hoax and conspiracy prevail. We can't allow that to happen. So we continue doing this critically important work, and I'm proud to say that it continues at Livermore today. We need evidence, which I think we'll be talking about in a few minutes. The courts need evidence, and scientists need to provide the best scientific information on the nature and causes of climate change.
But that work is going on at Livermore National Laboratory in the San Francisco Bay Area without you. You chose to leave. Why?
My departure was unfortunate. I guess that's the best way of putting it. One member of the Board of Governors, a very eminent physicist, Professor Stephen Coonan, had been invited to give a lecture at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. This will have been in May 2021. And Professor Coonan, not a climate scientist, but an eminent physicist, had just written a book entitled Unsettled, where the premise in the book was that climate science is unsettled, that despite all the fingerprinting and event attribution, we don't need to do anything about it. We need to study for another 20, 30 years and see how things turn out. The fact that Livermore was willing to give Professor Coonan a lecture to speak about his book, and the fact that Professor Coonan was resistant to the idea of actually interacting with Livermore scientists and learning about fingerprinting or learning more about climate models and climate model evaluation, that was terrible. How could something like that be happening at a national lab? I did not understand. So I decided that I publicly, and I did, and that was a very, very difficult personal decision for me. I recognized that in the act of speaking out publicly, I would be burning bridges. But again, there are times when you have to choose, when there's a fork in the road. And those choices may be tremendously difficult. Be brave when you reach that fork in the road and you have to choose. And I'm proud that I chose to defend the work that we had done for three decades at Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
And so were you fired? Did they make it uncomfortable? Did you just decide, like, this is, I'm out?
I decided that I was out. I was not fired. Let me be very clear on that. I had hoped to continue to have some sort of status at Livermore as a researcher who had spent 30 years there. But after this incident, I decided that I did not want that anymore, and that the only way that the institution could change was if it experienced a hard consequence, if it recognized that this is not the way you treat your climate scientists, particularly your younger scientists, to show them this form of disrespect. Yeah, we care about the work that you do, but this guy's powerful and can do a lot of good for us. And even if he's using this lecture as a platform for casting doubt on the reality and seriousness of climate change, he's important to us. No. I think you have to choose, particularly if you're a national lab, science.
So you left, and the work goes on. You left, took your principled stand. You're now working at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. You're an atmospheric scientist, not an oceans person. What are you doing there? How do they let you in? And what are you learning?
Well, Woods Hole has kindly given me a 2 months per year gig. And it turns out that you can teach an old dog new tricks. So I have spent most of my professional life in the atmosphere, doing fingerprinting with temperature in the atmosphere, with moisture, with many different things. But I'm pretty ignorant when it comes to the ocean. This was an opportunity to do fingerprinting in the ocean, to learn from some of the best and the brightest. The folks at Woods Hole make a ton of interesting and innovative measurements of ocean temperature and salinity and what's happening under Antarctic ice shelves. And they build robotic systems that go to the depths of the ocean that now look at not only temperature and salinity, but ocean chemistry as well. My job is to try and interact with those folks who make the measurements and to use them for fingerprinting, for understanding how and why the oceans are changing. It's wonderful.
And the oceans have really saved us. They're mind-boggling. I mean, the oceans are absorbing a huge amount of carbon. And if they weren't doing that, it would be insanely more hot, right?
Yeah, the oceans have been absorbing much of the heat, over 90% of the heat that we have generated by burning fossil fuels and increasing levels of heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So it seems critically important to understand how the oceans are changing, particularly at depth, where we have so few measurements. Much of the ocean is tabula rasa, and the folks at Woods Hole and many other oceanographic institutions around the world are trying to fill in the gaps and help us understand how the oceans are changing. So it's wonderful at this late stage in my life to be mentoring young students, to be thinking about the oceans, and to recognize that my expertise still has value to others.
This is the Commonwealth Club radio program, and I'm Gloria Duffy. Today, we're hearing a conversation with atmospheric scientist Ben Santer about the impact of his work identifying the human influence driving the climate crisis. Get the inside scoop on Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California, our events, our travel program, and more by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email. Now, here's Greg Dalton again with Ben Santer.
Do you feel more free not working for a national lab? Can you be more edgy with your words? Working for a national lab, there's certain constraints. Do you feel liberated?
I was always pretty edgy, I would say. But I was very mindful of my colleagues. You know, I was for some period of time until my colleague Celine Bonfi, who's here in the audience tonight, took over. I was the leader of the Climate Change Detection and Attribution Group at Lawrence Livermore. And these were my colleagues in that group and my friends. And I didn't want to do anything that might negatively impact them, their funding, their families. So it was very difficult being in that position where you're charged with trying to secure funding for a group. But at the same time, as you're charged with doing that, the very work you're doing is coming under unjustified political attack. What do? Do you just zip it and say nothing? Or do you continue to try and do the best research you possibly can while also speaking publicly about the importance of doing that work? That's what I chose to do.
And there's quite a debate now about scientists, whether they ought to stay in their lane, or you know, some scientists get political and start making policy prescriptions. Rose Abramoff was fired from a national lab for protesting. Yeah. What do you think is the, you know, we are in this urgent crisis. What is the appropriate role of a scientist, and where are